Psalm 44. I want to thank Mark Francis for taking Psalm 43 last week. Appreciate that. If you notice within the heading of Psalm 44, just by way of remembrance, it says, for the choir director, a maskil of the sons of Korah. And hopefully from 2 weeks ago, you remember about the sons of Korah, that their father Korah led a rebellion against the leaders of Israel that God had appointed and anointed in Moses and Aaron. And because of that, there was Korah, Dathan, and Abiram, and 250 other prominent men of Israel who had raised up to oppose Moses and Aaron. And as a result of that, they all brought these bronze censers to offer up an offering to God. And God opened up the earth and swallowed them all. And Moses and Aaron were told, you take those bronze censers and you hammer them up on the altar of burnt offering in the tabernacle. And let them be a remembrance, a memorial for what has happened this day. And realize, for the sons of Korah who did not join in the rebellion of their father, it was a constant reminder of that God has chosen who the leaders are. And they are to be honored in a way that is holy and righteous. And because of that, these sons of Korah are also those who, in the tabernacle, and later on even the descendants, are going to be those who sing in the temple and sing many of these psalms that we're reading about, specifically starting in Psalm 42 and going all the way through 49 through here. And then there's some others that come along in the 80s of the psalms. And so what you notice in thinking about as we study through these psalms, think about, why would God want these things to resonate among His people? No matter among what generation they come through. Of course, the sons of Korah immediately serve in the tabernacle, and then 500 years later, in the days of David, it's still going to be the sons of Korah. And even 150 years later, in the days of Jehoshaphat, the sons of Korah are going to be singing in the temple. And to understand, to always remember about what they are to say, what they are to sing, the encouragement to give to God's people as they come to worship. And you'll notice in some things, they are warnings. I want you to take a minute to go back, look back at 2 Kings chapter 19. 2 Kings chapter 19. In order to really see not necessarily the setting of Psalm 44, but to understand this idea of a faithful remnant who are faithful to God even when the vast majority of Israel is not, or even before that time and even beyond. In 2 Kings chapter 18, the king of Assyria by the name of Sennacherib has sent down an army and basically three men, I guess you could call them ambassadors. They're really not there to bring about any kind of peace. They're there to make a proclamation of war. And Rabshakeh is the name of the kind of the mouthpiece for the king of Assyria. And he gives all these boasts, even to the point that they're being said openly in the Hebrew language. And those who are of Judah cry out and say, speak in your own language. Don't speak it so that all the people on the wall can hear. And it's as if they take that as the sign to go, well, we need to say it even louder and even stronger. And Rabshakeh makes these statements about, we've destroyed all these other nations, and now we're going to destroy you, and there's nothing your God can do about it. We've destroyed all these other gods that are in the land, which of course were false gods. He says, and now we're coming after you. And for Hezekiah, who's king of Judah, he listens to these things and he gets concerned, because this army has swept down through from Assyria and they have annihilated nation after nation after nation. And so Hezekiah calls upon Isaiah the prophet, who is a contemporary with Hezekiah. Hezekiah is from about 715 to about 686 B.C. And if you look at these first seven verses of 2 Kings 19, it says, "And when King Hezekiah heard it, he tore his clothes, covered himself with sackcloth, and entered the house of the Lord." He hears these threats from Assyria, and notice his response is not one of pride. It's not one of arrogance. Covers himself in sackcloth. He says, he enters into the house of the Lord, verse 2. "Then he sent Eliakim, who was over the household with Shebna the scribe, and the elders of the priests, covered with sackcloth, to Isaiah the prophet, the son of Amoz." He says, you go to Isaiah for me, on my behalf. Verse 3. "They said to him, thus says Hezekiah, this day is a day of distress, rebuke, and rejection, for children have come to birth, and there is no strength to deliver." It's as if, here's this great army coming to fight against us. What kind of power do we have to overcome here? He says, it's like a woman who's come to deliver, but she no longer has the strength to push. Then verse 4. He says, "Perhaps the Lord your God will hear all the words of Rabshakeh, whom his master, the king of Assyria, has sent to reproach the living God, and will rebuke the words which the Lord your God has heard. Therefore, offer a prayer for the remnant that is left." He says, here are the people that are in the city of Jerusalem. He says, Isaiah, would you pray for the remnant that's here? Because if you look at Rabshakeh, if you look at Sennacherib's history, what they had been doing lately with their army, on the surface, on the physical side, it looks like Jerusalem's about to go down. But they also know, if we appeal to God, cover themselves in sackcloth, go to the house of the Lord, inquire of the Lord, inquire of his prophet Isaiah. Isaiah, will you pray for the remnant that's here? We're going to strive to do what's right. Then, verse 5. He says, "So the servants of King Hezekiah came to Isaiah." They brought that exact message. "Isaiah said to them, thus you shall say to your master." Isaiah sends this message back to Hezekiah, the king of Judah. He says, "Thus says the Lord, do not be afraid because of the words that you have heard, with which the servants of the king of Assyria have blasphemed me." He says, "Behold, I will put a spirit in him so that he will hear a rumor and return to his own land, and I will make him fall by the sword in his own land." He says, you have nothing to worry about. Can you imagine? Here you are in Jerusalem. Army of Assyria is outside. They basically had an undefeated record up to this point in destroying all the nations that are around. And you appeal to God and you ask Isaiah, will you pray for this remnant, the striving to please God? And Isaiah appeals to God and Isaiah gets a message back to say, you don't have to worry about this. He says, I'm going to put a rumor in his ear, and they're going to all go away. They're not even going to step foot in this city. Now, if you're someone of faith, what do you receive in that message? Hope. You realize, oh, we're going to be great. If you're faithless and you receive that message, what happens? You don't believe it. You find any hope? Find any reassurance? See how faith has a vital part? Are we really going to trust God at His Word or not? Then, I want you to look a little bit further down in the chapter. There's so much in between that would be good, but look down at verse 29. Once again, see it talk about this remnant. He says, "Then this shall be the sign for you. You will eat this year what grows of itself, and the second year what springs from the same. In the third year sow, reap, plant vineyards, and eat their fruit." He says, you're going to be here for a while. And granted, they're going to be there for another 100 years until the Babylonians come in to take them captive because of their wickedness. He says, go ahead and plant, and you're going to eat here. You don't have to worry about this army. Now remember, While these things are being said, the army's still outside and saying, this is what's going to happen. Then verse 30. The surviving remnant of the house of Judah will again take root downward and bear fruit upward. What does the remnant do? It grows. Notice the idea. They root downward and they bear fruit upward. There's some parallels with this in the New Testament where it talks about being grounded and rooted in Jesus. And the idea is, and yet you set your eyes on the things above. You're reaching upward toward God, even though you're rooted in Jesus. And you see for them, this is how the remnant responds. This is a faithful people. He says, you root downward and you bear fruit upward. Then he's going to use remnant again. Look at verse 31. He says, for out of Jerusalem will go forth a remnant, and out of Mount Zion survivors. The zeal of the Lord will perform this. He says, you're going to go out from Jerusalem, this remnant. This faithful remnant, like I said, let's flash forward 100 years. All of a sudden, Judah's gone right back to wickedness, and they get carried off by the Babylonians. But yet there's this faithful remnant that continues to go forward. If you think about men like Daniel, he's taken captive, along with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And yet, what do they show in the midst of captivity? Faithfulness. They still trust God, even though they've been taken off to a foreign land. Then you think about other stories like Mordecai and Esther, as the Persians come in. Once again, a faithful remnant. Mordecai even telling Esther, if you don't do something, God's going to provide for us from somewhere else. Which tells you about there's faithfulness. Then you even go a little bit further along, around 450 plus or minus 10 years, just a kind of a general thought. Then come in men like Ezra the scribe, who want to do things God's way. You find men like Nehemiah, who are going to go back along with Ezra to reestablish what should be there in the promised land. And yet for all these things to see, there's a remnant that goes all the way through this ribbon of faithful people. Sometimes they're surrounded by God's own people who have turned to wickedness and turned of all these other things, even back to idols. But yet in the midst of everything going on, there's still this faithful remnant that continues to walk with God, even while others in their own nation do not. And they're always provided for and taken care of. It doesn't mean they don't come into difficulties. It doesn't mean some of them aren't killed. But yet at the same time, you see there's always this faithful remnant at hand. Now, come back over to Psalm 44. Look at verse 1. And notice it doesn't say that this psalm was written by David. So we're dealing with a kind of a time frame a little bit further down the road than in the days of David. He says, O King, we have heard with our ears, our fathers have told us, the work that you did in their days, in the days of old. How important is it for the stories about how God has responded for His people and toward His people for the future? To share those things about what God has done with our children, grandchildren, with one another who are around. He says, we have heard it with our ears. Our forefathers told us about what you did. If you look back at the book of Judges, in Judges chapter 2, it talks about after the days of Joshua and the generation that were with him. He says, there came up a generation that did not know God, nor did they know what He had done for the deliverance of Israel. They decided among that generation, they didn't tell the story. While it was still an oral history for a lot of things, but there were already some books that were written in the first five books of the Old Testament. But you go, all of a sudden comes this generation that doesn't even know about God anymore. And what do you suspect they would do next? They fall away from faithfulness toward God. And then God has to rise up judges as part of this ongoing cycle. About they get themselves completely in trouble because of their evil. God gives them over to a leader of another nation, and they get pummeled, and then finally they cry out to the Lord. Then he sends a judge, they get delivered, they do really good, except for they don't hold to the things of God when things go really well. And then it sinks back into that same cycle, and you just see it over and over and over again through the book of Judges. Now, here if you notice it in verse 1 of Psalm 44, he says, here's a generation that says, we've heard this. We know what God's done in the days of our father. Verse 2, he says, you with your own hand drove out the nations. Then you planted them. You afflicted the peoples. Then you spread them abroad. He says, we've heard the stories of whenever God's people came and took over the promised land. Took out these seven nations, the Hittites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. He says, utterly destroyed them. Almost. Then they lost faithfulness. And once again, if you go back and you read Judges, you'll start to notice there are seven of the tribes that are mentioned by name that did not completely destroy the nations in their own region of what had been given to them. And it happened just the way God said it would. And all of a sudden, because of their being unfaithful to God, each of them paid the price for it. Now, once again, you hear, here's what God promised, and here's what God did, here's what the people were supposed to do in taking over the land, and they just gave a half-hearted effort, and they said, that's good enough for us. But it just so turns out, it's not good enough for who? It's not good enough for God. Which means, in turn, it's really not going to be good enough for you. Now, he continues on here in verse 2. He says, you afflicted the peoples, you afflicted the peoples, you spread them out abroad. He says, they got ran off. But if you notice, it says, then you planted them, talking about God's own people. What were they supposed to do if they were faithful? Root down, bear fruit up. And to realize, verse 3, he says, for by their own sword they did not possess the land, and their own arm did not save them. He says, but your right hand and your arm and the light of your presence, for you favored them. Whenever they were faithful, what did they realize? Look at what the Lord's done. And how did they look at themselves? No, just the opposite. What did they say? They say, we know it's not by our hand. It's not by our sword that did this. See what happens when you're rooted into the Lord? You start to recognize, you know, these successes that we're having, they're not because of us. It's not because of how great of fighters we are. It's not because of how strong we are. It's because of our God. Because when he makes a statement, it says, for by their own sword they did not possess the land. By their own arm, they did not save them. He says, but God's right hand, his arm, and the light of his presence. He says, because they found favor with God. Now, verses 4 through 8, you're going to see the response of the remnant. In the midst of all these things, our fathers have told us about what God did before. We know what he did to the nations. We know his power is what allowed us to live in this land. Then comes verse 4. You are my king, O God. Command victories for Jacob. What does it mean when you claim a king? What does that statement mean to you in terms of saying, God, you are my king? What do you think? You put yourself in subjection to him. What else? Loyalty, authority, we'll follow. Which kind of goes together with subjection, but to go, look, we're attentive to your word. We're not going to just listen, we're going to respond. And you find the loyalty that Rick brought up. And you go, here's a response. It's not just I tip my cap to you, you're my king. if you've ever kind of noticed the way things get depicted, and even if you read the histories of it, of going, when the king shows up, what do the people do? They bow down. They bow the knee. He says, "You are my king, O God." Now, think about the sons of Korah singing this in the temple. What did all of Israel and Judah need to hear? You need to bow the knee to the king. You need to realize where all your blessings come from. It is not by your power, it's not by your wisdom, it's not by your might. Remember who your king is. And of course, for us, the parallel, who's our king? Jesus is. Do we bow the knee to him? Now, he says, command victories for Jacob. Of course, talking about Israel. Verse 5, through you we will push back our adversaries. Through your name we will trample down those who rise up against us. Once again, where are they putting the emphasis? It's on God and his power, not ours. Because notice the next verse. Verse 6, he says, for I will not trust in my bow, nor will my sword save me. He says, it's not because how good of an eye I have on sight with my bow. If you remember, they used to sing a song about David. They'd say, Saul's killed his thousands, David's killed his 10,000s. And yet David makes similar statements to this by saying, it's not because of my sword, it's because of my God. And they go, even though everybody else is trying to lift up David like he's something special, the reason that David is grounded, because he knows who's actually at hand and who these victories are coming through. Now, notice how he continues. Verse 7. He says, but you have saved us from our adversaries, and you have put to shame those who hate us. In God we have boasted all day long, and we will give thanks to your name forever, Selah. He says, you're the one who delivers over and over again. It's the same thing that Hezekiah saw. He got to see it up front. When Isaiah told him, look, God said, you don't have to worry about them. You can go out and you can plant. He says, this remnant's going to be here for a while. And to go, you watch what happens with this great army of the Assyrians outside. You're just going to one day pick up and go, where'd they go? Because they just get whisper of a rumor and they go back home. Now, you see it here. He says, in God we have boasted all day long, and we will give thanks to your name forever. Who is our boast in? It's in Jesus. How often is it tempting to be in ourselves? Well, you know, I've done this so long, I know a whole lot. Oh, I'm pretty smart. I'm pretty strong. I'm pretty cunning on how I do business. Sometimes we start to pat ourselves on the back so much we break our own arm. But to realize, if you're going to be part of the remnant, who do you really know is at hand? It's the Lord that's doing these things. It's the boast of, it's by Jesus that we find salvation. It's not because of how perfect I can live my life, even though we strive to do that. So, notice as it continues, you see all these things together. We'll give thanks to your name forever. We're never going to change that. And may that be our heart's response. And then comes these next verses, in verses 9 through 16. And if you don't understand this remnant idea, you'll look at this and this will just be a big old head scratcher. Like, I thought we were doing things the right way. What happened? Look at verse 9. He says, yet you have rejected us and brought us to dishonor, and do not go out with our armies. You cause us to turn back from the adversary, and those who hate us have taken spoil for themselves. You gave us as sheep to be eaten, and have scattered us among the nations. What's going on? They've not been faithful. Now, there is a faithful remnant in the midst of Judah. But what's going on with the majority? They're going back to the old evil things, aren't they? And if you notice, he says, How come you don't go out with the army anymore? We can tell your presence isn't with us. How do you think they figured that one out? Because they lost. If you remember, this is not the setting of this, but if you remember whenever they went to take the promised land, I mean, Jericho falls, greatest fortified city in the whole land, it falls with them just obeying God's command and walking around and doing it just right, as God said. And then, because some things were stolen from God in terms of that were from the band, all of a sudden they go to take a little old piddly city like Ai, and they decide, we don't even need to take a whole lot of folks. That's so small. And then what happens? They got whooped. They got defeated. And then Joshua cries out to God. He doesn't know what's happened. He didn't know that those things have been taken under the ban. But there's one thing he knew for sure. Something happened. Because God's not with us in this. What's happened? And he turns to God, and what does God do? He tells him why. And then it's time to make a change. And Achan's dealt with along with his family. But you start to see, how could they figure these things out? Because all of a sudden, it's not turning out well. And Judah, as well as Israel, gets taken off into captivity. And they realize, what has happened? Now, he says, our adversaries are winning. He says, they even take our things for spoil. And then verse 11 says, you have given us as sheep to be eaten. You talk about a sacrificial lamb. I'm going, we're just being gobbled up. Then he says, and have scattered us among the nations. Judah goes off into captivity in Babylon. Israel taken into captivity up with Assyria. And to go, we've been spread out all over the place. Then, even verse 12, he says, you sell your people cheaply and have not profited by their sale. He says, things are being sold off so cheaply, he says, you're not even making any money on us. I mean, it's almost, probably the parallel for today would be like having a yard sale. It's like, I paid $100 for this object and now I'm selling it for $5? This is a losing effort. And you think, he says, we're being sold off cheaply. Verse 16, you make us a reproach to our neighbors, a scoffing and a derision to those around us. You make us a byword among the nations, a laughingstock among the peoples. And what do the nations have to say about Judah and Israel? Where's your God? I thought you guys were all strong and mighty with your God. And now you can't even... If you want a parallel from the book of Judges, you think about the impressive strength of Samson, able to lift the whole gates of Gaza and carry them uphill some 35 miles away and plant them at the top of the mountain. And then yet, after he is no longer faithful to God, he's being led around after his eyes have been plucked out by a little boy. And he's just a laughingstock. And why is he a laughingstock? He didn't value the things of God. He wouldn't honor God's commands. He says, here he is. And this was God's people. And you imagine, for men like Daniel, for men like Ezra, for men like Mordecai, or for a woman like Esther, of going in the midst of God's people being a laughingstock, to still see part of this remnant who are faithful and them to be provided for and taken care of in the midst of the whole nation being made fun of by their captors. And you go, you think that might be hard to watch? To think, this could be so different if God's people were people of faith toward the commandments of God. If you notice how it continues, verse 15, he says, all day long my dishonor is before me, and my humiliation is overwhelming. He says, because of the voice of him who reproaches and reviles, because of the presence of the enemy and the avenger. He says, This is what I hear all day long. You imagine striving to live by faith and obedience to God and His commands in the midst of God's own people not being obedient, in the midst of being carried off into captivity that God has allowed because of the wickedness of His people as a whole. And yet He still provides for His faithful people in the midst of that group. I wish we had the time to really look back at Deuteronomy, specifically Deuteronomy 28. It's really verses like 15 through 68. If you want to go back and read that on your own, I would encourage you to do that. What it talks about is when God's people get cursed by God because they won't listen to His commands, because they won't humble themselves, because they won't honor their king and being God. And because of that, all of a sudden, the diseases that come upon their bodies, the way that God affects the environment of the land to where it no longer grows its food the way it used to, the way that even wild beasts are at hand, the way that all of a sudden they are made fun of, they're a laughing stock from the people who they've been taken into captivity for, all kinds of other disgusting things that are mentioned there. But you realize you don't honor God and God will curse you. And that's exactly what this remnant, this faithful remnant is watching as they see the rest of the nation of God's people going, look at what God has done to us. Daniel getting carried off into captivity with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And yet striving by faith to do things God's way and to take care of that faithful remnant in the midst of this heap of evil that God's people have done. And God is just. And so He carries His people off into captivity. But He takes care of His faithful remnant. And they look around and see all these things that are going on, even being a laughingstock, even being mocked. And to go, why has this happened? And to understand why. Because we didn't obey God. Because we didn't honor His commands. And look at what it's come to. Now, if you notice here, it says, we're dishonored all day long, but I want to show you the heart of the remnant. Look at verses 17, 18, and 19. Because this is the heart of the faithful. Verse 17. All this has come upon us, but we have not forgotten you, and we have not dealt falsely with your covenant. Look, the nation as a whole has dealt falsely with the covenant. The nation as a whole has forgotten about God. But there's still this faithful remnant within them who's still holding to God and says, we have not forgotten you, and we still honor your covenant. You think about Daniel as he's in captivity. He's still going to pray facing Jerusalem every day. He's not going to stop. Even whenever laws are passed that are specifically aimed at destroying Daniel by his contemporaries, he's not going to stop honoring his God. And sure enough, when he's thrown into the lion's den and mocked, God delivers it and takes care of it. And you see, because He honors the covenant of God. He doesn't stop just because things get difficult and hard. He doesn't stop just because God's people get carried off into captivity. He says, I have not forgotten you. I've been carried away, but I haven't forgotten you. Verse 18. He says, our heart has not turned back and our steps have not deviated from your way. He says, our hearts haven't turned to these gods of the Babylonians. He says, we haven't stepped away from your way. I mean, you think of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, as well as Daniel saying, we're not going to eat these defiled, contaminated foods. He says, we're going to honor God. And they do it in a lawful way to ask the one who's over them, this is what we want to do. And he says, I'll let you do it for 10 days. And they eat vegetables and they eat what is clean. And they look better after 10 days than all the others do who are eating the king's highest rations. God shows them favor because they're going to honor His covenant. And you realize their hearts haven't turned back and their steps haven't deviated from God's way, even though they're not in Jerusalem anymore or even in Canaan anymore. Then, verse 19, he says, "Yet you have crushed us in a place of jackals and covered us with the shadow of death." He says, "Yet we're still not back home in Canaan. We're not back in the promised land." He says, "We're in the land of the jackals. Jackals are hunting and searching." And he even says, "and covered us with the shadow of death." I mean, this probably makes you think about Psalm 23, about being in the shadow of death. If you just think about the picture in your mind, in order to have a shadow, the sun has to be out. And if you think about the sun being here and casting a light upon death, on the other side there's a shadow of death. You're getting really close to death. It almost looks like death's getting right there at the door, kind of like Daniel in the lion's den. I'm right here in the shadow of death. But you take care of me. And you realize how many times when you're in the midst of a people who are wicked, to go, "Can God still take care of me if I turn and do what's right?" You may come even into the shadow of death. And yet the Lord can still provide. Now, you look at what's here. Now he flips back in verse 20. He's talking about, and here's why. Here's why not to turn around. He says, "If we had forgotten the name of our God or extended our hands to a strange God, would not God find this out?" He says, how could we be so foolish as to turn away from God? To think that we could hide? To think that I'll be the only one who knows, and to go, how foolish. If we were to go along with these Babylonian gods, wouldn't God know? It can't be a secret from Him. Then the rest of verse 21, "for He knows the secrets of the heart." It's one of those things that I think we easily grasp mentally. But does it change the way we think to realize, are these thoughts that I'm having, are these meditations really what would be pleasing to God? About all the worries, all the anxieties, all the thinking, maybe there's a different way out of this other than God's ways. And you start to look at that and go, God knows the secrets of the heart. And He knows if I forget Him. And He knows if I leave His paths. And I'm going to end up like the rest of this group. I'm not going to be part of a remnant. I'm going to be part of those that go down. Now, he brings you to this point and to realize, verse 22, and you, I think you can see different levels of this. "But for your sake we are killed all day long. We are considered as sheep to be slaughtered." He says, "Yet look at the people." He says, "We're just going down one by one." If you've ever been to a big farming place where it is the day of slaughter, whether it be for lambs or whether it be for cows, and just to see them line up, it doesn't work that easy, but the idea. And go ahead, just going to be one after another. Even in pigs, you just go one after another. Going to be slaughtered. Going to be divided up. And he says, that's the way it feels. Now, there's a feeling versus a reality. You ever see the difference in those two? There's a way you feel about a situation, and then there's the real situation. He says, "For your sake we are killed all day long. We are considered as sheep to be slaughtered." This verse is actually quoted in Romans chapter 8. Specifically, as you look at it in Romans chapter 8, verse 36, to go, it's talked about in a little bit of a different way. Paul's talking to the saints in Rome, And in being in Rome, there's also going to be a lot of difficulties in Rome. In terms of Nero being the emperor, Nero blaming the Christians for things that Nero started in the fire within the city to burn it down. To understand saints were going to deal even with in terms of being sewn into animal skins and then to be thrown out among wild beasts. To be taken and put in clothing and dipped in wax and hung upon an axle tree or a rod and lit on fire just to illuminate the emperor's garden. What do you think it would feel like? Know that your own brothers and sisters in Christ are being treated that way? I think it feels like we're being led off to slaughter. Think it would affect the way you thought about things? Might you start to wonder, should we turn away from our God? Is it time to move in a different direction? Is it time to turn toward the gods of the Romans? To renounce Christianity? Anything having to do with those things? And yet specifically in Romans, it says, who will separate us from the love of Christ? Well, tribulation or distress or persecution or famine or nakedness or peril or sword. Just as it is written, for your sake we are being put to death all day long. We were considered as sheep to be slaughtered. But in all these things we overwhelmingly conquer through Him who loves us. And to realize, Stephen died a martyr's death. And yet Stephen was so faithful. To see James, the brother of John, die a martyr's death by the hands of Herod. And yet to be faithful. And to realize, seeing that I cannot be separated from the love of God, am I going to continue to turn to God and do things His way, even if it means my own death? For that to be quoted in Romans 8 was to say, you better think about these things. I'll take care of you. There's an overwhelmingly conquering that's going to go on. It's called eternal life. It's not about what's just here. And to focus there, then hopefully you've already thought about Isaiah 53, verse 7, where the prophecy is about Jesus, like a lamb being led off to slaughter. Holiness. Then, and mocked as well. Then if you notice what else is here, Psalm 44, verse 23, the cry out is, arouse yourself, why do you sleep, O Lord? Awake, do not reject us forever. If you look at Psalm 121, it inevitably and very distinctly says, look, the God of Israel does not sleep and He does not slumber. But yet, what is the perception on the outside looking in? Does He not care? Will He rouse up and deliver us? Is He asleep? Yet the reality is, who is standing at control? Who's delivering and continuing to protect His remnant? God is. Then, notice how He continues, verse 24. He says, why do you hide your face and forget our affliction and our oppression? He says, why? Then, verse 25, For our soul has sunk down into the dust, our body cleaves to the earth. Rise up, be our help, and redeem us for the sake of your loving kindness, for the sake of your covenant. Is that not exactly what Jesus did? Did He not go down to the depths with His soul, only to have God raise Him up so that we could be redeemed by this new covenant that He enacted by His blood and His resurrection? And you realize, at times it looks like, is God falling asleep? Look at what these Christians have to go through. He protects His remnant. Be faithful to the end. All right. Next week, come back and look at Psalm 45.